Blog Talk Radio.
And good day from Fairfax, Virginia. This is the July 15th edition of Military Monday. It is a warm, muggy, but very sunshiny day here in Fairfax. And we're going to go and do a good news show today. We've had a couple of weeks where we've talked about the developments over in the Middle East and other places. And we're going to talk a little bit about something a little more pleasant and a little more promising today. And that is the subject of Navy unmanned aerial vehicles. Now, obviously, UAVs, drones, whatever you care to call them, are a controversial subject because of their use and implementation. But a lot of people don't know that the U.S. Navy has been, while not lagging in the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, has been taking a somewhat more methodical and systems and missions-based approach to bringing them into the fleet for widespread use. And to talk about that today, especially the developments of last week with the first automated carrier landing of the X-47B prototype on the George Bush, we're going to have a couple of people who know a whole lot about this subject. Rick Burgess, the managing editor and senior writer for Sea Power magazine, which is put out by the U.S. Navy League. And in addition, we're going to have a good friend of mine who I've known for some years, Captain Chuck Nash, a retired Navy captain who ran requirements during the late 1990s for the Navy regarding naval aviation, commanded a strike fighter squadron of F-18s, the Fighting Kestrels of VFA-137, and is today a well-known, and you've probably seen him, Fox News analyst whenever the really, really serious shooting gets started. And gentlemen, are you there?
Indeed.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Hello, Rick. Hello, Chuck. How are you guys doing today?
Doing well, and I agree with your assessment. It is a hot and muggy day in your nation's capital.
Yes. And with that, I'd like to go out and just say, if there was ever a time when the Navy was showing its commitment to unmanned systems, it certainly is now. And I'm going to start with you, Rick. Talk about how the Navy has been gradually, but with ever-gathering momentum, been embracing UAVs of various flavors to go ahead and support manned naval aviation in the fleet.
Yes, well, the Navy does have quite a history of unmanned aviation that goes back at least to World War II. They used TDR drones to as flying bombs for missions. So I guess it's more of a cruise missile concept than but they were unmanned systems, very crude ones, but they did the job. In the Korean War, we actually had carrier-launched F-6F Hellcats configured as cruise missiles to strike targets in North Korea. And so we do have some history of that that goes back far away, but it really didn't get started in earnest until the development of the Pioneer UAV, which served well in the Persian Gulf War, launched from surface ships and also used by the Marine Corps. But that the Pioneer really got the Navy to thinking about how unmanned systems could be used. And they've slowly been developed both in not only in capability but also in size. And now, as you mentioned, we've had the first carrier landing of a UAV in history, 112 years after the beginning of U.S. naval aviation. And it's opening up a lot of avenues, and I think it's going to have a lot of potential in the future.
Now, Chuck, you've been in the Navy. You spent a whole career there before you started your career informing the rest of us about military matters. What was the attitude back in the 90s when you were working requirements for the Navy? What was the attitude towards unmanned systems out there, and particularly out in the fleet, if you can give us a sense of that?
Yeah, it was more along the lines, John, of being experimental. Even though Rick just did a great job of pointing out what the history was, in fact, that it's not a new idea at all, it was approached then as if it was kind of a new idea. And if you really come to think about it, what happened is you start out with a concept for something which was really unarmed, but unmanned, and these were drones. So how do we fit these into manned carrier aviation? What are the challenges? And I think what we started doing was focusing too much on the challenges and not enough on, but if we could solve that, what would the benefits be? So we were looking at it more along the lines of, this is going to be a challenge to do this, and then what's the value proposition for that challenge? And in you know, so that's kind of how we approached it, and then along came the Gulf War, then came Gulf War II, and all of a sudden, in undefended, uncontested airspace, we found that these things had quite a bit of utility, reduced sorties and everything. So I think the perception of their value proposition and the understanding of the challenges are much more in focus now than they've ever been.
Chuck, to follow that up, explain to our listeners why operating in a maritime environment, in other words, why putting a helicopter on the back of a frigate or a cruiser or a destroyer or flying a fixed-wing aircraft off of a carrier deck, what are the challenges that exist in doing that as opposed to operating an F-16 off a 10,000-foot dry runway somewhere?
Yeah. Well, unless you've got maybe 6 or 8 times the magnitude force of the San Francisco earthquake, an F-16 is going to have a pretty straightforward job of coming back. The other thing is, if weather is poor at his intended point of landing, he's filed for a divert field under instrument flight rules. So there are divert fields around. There are plenty of communications, redundant communications, and the ground's not moving. If you come back aboard a maritime platform, I can guarantee you the platform's moving somewhat, and in some cases it could be out of parameters. So you have to adjust your mission to be able to respond to very rapidly changing environmental conditions. So if you have something that's 500 miles away that flies at 200 miles an hour, you have to make that decision early on, and you may not know how much the airfield's going to be moving when that thing gets back. So there's a time distance element, but you cannot control the environment. You just cannot control the environment. And so it's not just the weather above, it's the platform motion below. And only one of those things exists over land.
And Rick, I'm going to let you throw in your thoughts here, because even firmly tied to the deck, just sitting there, the maritime environment is an unforgiving thing compared to most military air bases on dry land. Give us a little insight into what happens to a naval aviation airframe or platform as it sits there on deck.
Well, you have the challenges of the salt air with corrosion from the salt spray and so forth. You have a very tight environment in which to taxi your aircraft. The big challenge in taxiing an unmanned aircraft is how do you do that with all the radio interference that's going on with the communications that are normal to the flight deck and positioning on the catapult or when after it lands, taxiing it into the parking spot. And the Navy and the Northrop Grumman team seem to have conquered that challenge and been able to get the aircraft controlled on the deck and in a way that enabled it to operate safely to and from the aircraft carrier. You also have you have to have people be the flight deck personnel be aware of an unmanned aircraft taxiing and avoiding getting in the way of it. And you have to be able to control the airplane in the carrier control zone and not have it collide with other aircraft. And so it's quite a challenge. And I think the test last Wednesday, and they're by the way, they're being repeated today off the coast of Virginia. They'll continue to show that the Navy's and Northrop Grumman have figured this problem out.
And we'll get on more to the X-47 a little later. Back to Chuck. Now, there is another value to unmanned aerial vehicles in that they're cheaper, they tend to be smaller. And how does this assist the Navy in filling their decks and landing spots from everything from frigates and littoral combat ships up to the big carriers? What has been the trend in terms of those platforms, and how are we doing it, filling them up with airplanes that can do the missions?
Well, I think for small combatants, frigates, destroyers, in fact, all the way up to cruisers, once you start to have a demand for self-targeting or reconnaissance or surveillance, where you want to keep track of something and you want to do it surreptitiously, you can either launch your LAMPS helicopter out there, which has a crew, and put them on station, and they're a pretty big radar target. So depending on the type of vessel that you're trying to surveil, keep tabs on, you may just want to do it with the radar on the ship once you identify what it is, and then keep the helicopter on standby in case you lose contact with it. If you have a small unmanned vehicle, you could launch that out there and have that smaller radar target hang around, watch it, link the image back to the mothership, and the helicopter crew could be getting crew rest for when you need something that demands a human interaction. Now, when we first started talking about UAVs, it was they're going to do the dirty, dangerous missions. They could also do the other D, which was the dull missions, which is hang out and watch this ship. So the best way to do that, lots of different ways to do it. That is one way that you could use an unmanned aerial vehicle. As for the cost, depending on the platform, the maintenance, the ground systems, and the actual usage, the Air Force did a study a few years back and found out that UAVs really weren't that much cheaper than a lot of the manned platforms. And so some more study is going to have to go into that as the technology improves and the investments are made. One can reasonably expect, just like laptop and desktop computers, that the capability will go up and the price will stabilize so that you can get a computer today for $2,200 that's far in advance of what you paid $2,200 for in pre-inflation dollars 5-10 years ago.
And Rick, back to you again. There's an added bonus, and that is you are not putting U.S. personnel's lives at risk. In other words, I have heard more cynical commentators than myself describe ejection seats more as hostage delivery systems than a piece of safety equipment in some ways. Yet you lose a UAV, nobody's going to even bother to have a memorial service with it, are they?
I suppose not. Yeah, with the Navy developing or having plans to develop an unmanned carrier system that can fly surveillance missions at long ranges and at long endurance over potentially hostile territory, obviously you don't risk losing a man or a crew in that situation. The absence of a person on board means you don't have to worry about the survival systems like the ejection seat and other things, the oxygen system. So you save a lot of weight. You can use that weight for fuel, and you get longer endurance. That's one of the major benefits of an unmanned system is the endurance that you can put into it. I mean, we're talking 24-hour-long missions now of the Navy's large Triton system that's coming in service in the next couple of years, as well as the unmanned carrier launch system that's being developed.
And, Chuck, as a naval aviator, we always come back to this. Are you sensitive to the fact that this machine wants your job, or at least wants part of your job?
No, not really, especially if it flies at night. I'm quite happy to give up bad weather night traps. But there is something from a political standpoint. You just brought it up with that last question to Rick. You'll recall back in April, I believe it was, 2001, a Navy EP-3 had a collision with a Chinese fighter. The EP-3, through some tremendous airmanship, the guy righted that airplane and landed on an island in China. Then they sat there for some 6-8 hours, buttoned up, sweating, while they trashed everything inside the airplane, running their destruct bill until they had to let the Chinese in. Now, what if we instead wanted to pack Tritons with the same type of ELINT, COMINT, SIGINT equipment and fly it up and down the coastline of China? So you say, well, we're not putting U.S. lives at risk. True. But there is a line that you cross when you shoot down a manned aircraft from another nation. What's the political line that you cross if you shoot down an unmanned aircraft? More to the point, if we did send those things out there and they became nothing more than target drones for Chinese fighters, is that not really showing political weakness when you're not willing to put a manned aircraft out there and draw the line?
You raise a new series of questions that leaders are going to have to answer when they get these things in their inventory, and perhaps another show we could talk about that. But you are correct. I mean, people have been shooting down reconnaissance aircraft for decades during the Cold War and the post-Cold War period, and it's always a serious escalation when it happens. We've darn near come close to war a couple of times with North Korea and China over it, and
precisely.
It's a valid point. Gentlemen, you've been periodically dropping the names of some systems, and I really want to give our listeners a chance to know a little bit about the systems that are being proposed, are in service, are coming into service, and are being envisioned for the future. And we're going to stick today not with the full gambit of Navy and Marine Corps systems, because the Marine Corps has their own entire story that's worthy of another show. But we're going to stick with the fleet today, the blue water and brown water navies that are going to be using these systems. And Chuck, I'm going to start with you. Go ahead and give us a sense, if you will, of how the Navy has approached over the last 15, 20 years the idea of going and either replacing, augmenting, or in fact creating brand new capabilities with unmanned systems and bringing them to the fleet. Can you give us a short explanation of that process and how they view it?
Yeah, I really think it is a process that was accomplished under a certain amount of duress. The Navy did not want to do it. It was considered something that was additive, both in cost and in effort. And again, since the Gulf War, I think there's been a new appreciation for what these things can bring. Today, in the fleet, ship COs are still under pressure to fly their UAV systems and start reporting on their UAV systems. Now, you could say, well, that's because maybe people are a little bit reluctant to use the new technology and we want them to use it. Or you could be cynical and say, we're trying to show that this investment we made is worth something, so you better fly it. Both, I think, have a place in the discussion. And in talking to people from the fleet and from the Pentagon, there is, the old question of opportunity cost for these things. And that is, if you put the money in this, what is it that you're taking the money from? Because really, in the end, it is pretty much a zero-sum game. So when Rick went through in his startup of all those systems that predated where we are now, I think it's really useful to go and look at really three key systems. One is what we're talking about that will eventually lead to UCLASS, which is an unmanned carrier-launched strike and surveillance system that can go out initially, probably be more focused on ISR, but eventually be weaponized and have a strike capability. The other system is something that would be on a small flight deck, like a small ship, like a destroyer or a frigate. And now you're talking about Fire Scout. And if you get even smaller, like LCS, then you get into the Scan Eagle, which is it's a Boeing product. It actually came from a small company on the West Coast called Insitsu. But so you have three major type platforms. When you go to land-based Navy, now you're into the Triton class. So as you look at the operational arcs and the endurance arcs of the three shipboard-based platforms, the large deck, the small deck, and we'll call it the littoral deck, and you fold over top of that the land-based arcs, what you start to see is that you've got it covered with multiple redundancies. And then the question is going to come back in this fiscally tight environment to how much of that redundancy do we need, and what is the cost for buying that? What are we giving up to buy that? And that's where we are right now, which is why I applaud the Navy's effort of doing this in a demonstration mode, not just running out, setting up a program, a record, and buying a bunch of things that they have not thoroughly studied. They're doing it right this time, and they're studying this and seeing how this all works.
Rick, you've covered these programs over a period now of, I guess, what, about 15 years. I know you've been writing about them. Talk a little bit about the process that Chuck just mentioned and how the combination of a solid demonstration program leading to some kind of acquisition of either a available system like Scan Eagle or a modified system like Fire Scout evolves. In other words, talk a little bit about the way the Navy approaches this and what, as he says, they've been doing it right this time. We haven't been hearing a lot of complaints about the UAV programs as we have JSF and some of the other programs of record.
Okay. Yeah, programs generally come about in two different ways. You either have a requirement defined by the headquarters staff or from a combatant commander, like, for example, the commander of U.S. Central Command might say, hey, I need a certain capability deployed in my region, and those requirements will go back to the joint staff, and they will filter down to the services, and they will come up with some ideas for solution, and they'll develop a program based on consultation with all the stakeholders, and they will do some alternatives, what they call analysis of alternatives, where they figure out what are the options they have to meet this requirement, and they will issue perhaps several contracts to companies to come up with concepts, and then they might pick one or two of those to develop a prototype, and then they'll pick what they consider the best option and issue a contract to that company to develop an engineering and manufacturing development model, a prototype, I guess you'd say, that they demonstrate, and then they'll design it, demonstrate it, and if it passes all of the there are several milestones, hoops it has to jump through, various approval boards, critical design review and so forth that it goes through, and then finally it is chosen for a limited rate production. And if Congress is satisfied with the progress of the program, it can be approved for a full rate production, and then away it goes out into service. The other way is you might have what's called a critical need, where a combatant commander might determine that he has a critical need and I need something in theater 6 months from now or a year from now. And you'll have a rather short-fused development cycle, and they'll typically take something off the shelf and try to deploy it, what they call early operational capability, getting it out there before you actually put it into full-rate production or even limited-rate production and test the system. And if it works, they might buy some more of the system. In the case of the demonstrators that we had the BAMS demonstrator. That's the RQ-4A. It was a Global Hawk that was converted with Navy systems, and they were flown out to the Persian Gulf area to perform missions under an experimental basis, and they were so happy with it they had decided to keep them out there, keep one out there at all times, and they bought they received some more Global Hawks that the Air Force had been retiring some of the older models, and they added those to the fleet, and those are a proving platform for the MQ-4C Trident, which will be a follow-on to that.
Now, earlier on, you were talking about, you know, all the things that you have to do just to let a airplane operate in a maritime environment. You and Chuck were talking about. Talk a little bit about a well-known issue, and that is the Navy has a saying, which is our lessons are written in blood and treasure. In other words, they have historically sometimes had a tough row to hoe going and putting new technologies, new systems into the fleet, and as a result are very conservative as they do it. And they haven't changed that for these unmanned systems, have they?
They've taken a very deliberate and careful approach, and I think the X-47 demonstration program is a very good example of doing it the right way. They took a very measured approach. They've taken their time to do it. They did a good job of understanding the problem because, as the captain said, landing on a carrier is one of the most difficult evolutions that exist in aviation today. They took this problem. They did a complete analysis of understanding all of the variables that needed to be considered, and they really fully understood the challenge. And they, the team got together, and the Navy and Northrop Grumman were very well in sync, and they performed on schedule when they expected to do it. And it's quite an impressive achievement. And I think it wouldn't surprise me if they were up for one of the Collier trophies or something like that.
Yeah, I've been thinking about the Collier and what they would probably, you know, how they would stand up in that. And right now, it's hard not to look at what happened last Wednesday as one of the great aviation achievements of the year, certainly if not of the decade. And with that, gentlemen, I want to talk about those systems we've been banning about the names of. And I'm going to start with you, Rick. Let's talk a little bit about ScanEagle, one of those off-the-shelf systems that really wasn't designed originally to operate off maritime platforms and really wasn't supposed to do the things it's been doing, but has adapted itself beautifully. Talk a little bit about ScanEagle.
That's right. ScanEagle was developed by the In-Situ Company in Bingen, Washington, and it was originally designed as a surveillance platform for the fishing industry off the coast of the west coast of the United States. And this system was looked at as a way to provide a low-cost unmanned area vehicle, primarily for the Marine Corps, but also for the Navy. And it is launched by a pneumatic catapult, which doesn't take very much space, and then it's retrieved by a what they call a skyhook system, where there's a wire suspended vertically on the ship, and the UAV is flown into the wire, and the wire slides down the wing and catches a hook on the wingtip, and the UAV spirals down and is recovered at the bottom of that spiral by the operators. Now, the interesting thing about the ScanEagle is that it is mostly operated by contractors, that is, In-Situ and their parent company now, Boeing. And so they provide these services. So most of the ScanEagles are not Navy or Marine Corps owned. However, the Navy did buy a few, or I should say Special Operations Command bought some because they couldn't obviously take contractors out in some of the places they operate. The ScanEagle carries an electrical, optical, or an infrared sensor. It's been also tested with a very small synthetic aperture radar called the NanoSAR. And it has been used in anti-piracy and maritime domain awareness missions out in the Indian Ocean and Persian Gulf. It's been deployed on amphibious warfare ships and also on destroyers. It's relatively small.
And of course, was a primary player in the Maersk, Alabama incident a couple years ago, providing continuous surveillance of the pirates both aboard the ship and later aboard the lifeboat.
That's correct.
So this has proven to be a useful little system, relatively low cost, off the shelf. You buy You buy it as a package of services and equipment. And how do you see this system continuing to work? Is it going to continue in service with the Navy, or are they going to go and move towards more of their own systems as we move along?
Well, the Navy made an initial move by they funded development of the RQ-21A integrator, which also is built by In-Situ. It's basically a larger equivalent of the Scan Eagle with twin booms. It can carry a larger sensor package. And they've developed this, and they intended it as rather than using contractor services operator, they were actually going to purchase these UAVs and train the military personnel to operate them. With the 2014 budget proposal, the Navy is backing off of this, at least for time being. They're sort of putting on a hold for the Navy. However, the Marine Corps is going to go ahead and acquire 32 systems, system meaning containing multiple UAVs. But the integrator, the RQ-21 integrator, is basically a successful Scan Eagle. So where it's sort of in flux right now as to whether, you know, how much the Navy is going to use the Scan Eagle in the future or not. I think that's in flux, and it's going to depend a lot on the 2014 budget and the 5-year defense plan that it begins.
Very good. Chuck, I'm going to let you take up the matter of helicopter UAVs, particularly the MQ-8B and C, the Fire Scout, and what is also going to be called Fire X, at least at this point. Go for it, sir.
Okay. Well, first, if I could just finish on one of Rick's points. I think he's exactly right. What the Pentagon is waiting for right now is, you tell me what the 2014 budget looks like, and I'll tell you what I'm going to do. And until that is determined, everything's on the table. The turnkey solution up to this point has served everyone really well. And the beauty of that turnkey solution is, if you don't buy the hardware and you don't buy all of the kit, if and when something better comes along that you like, you can just move to that and you don't have to worry about that sunk cost. So the turnkey solution seems to be working very well and is cost effective. As far as the helicopter UAVs, now we're down to what we'll call the mid-sized deck, or the small deck. It's not the littoral deck. And these are ships that have had aviation detachments on them before, going back to H-3 helicopters and now with LAMPS helicopters. And they're used to hosting aviation detachments. They're used to operating aerial vehicles, and now the difference is that some of the LAMP squadrons have Fire Scout Bs, Fire Scout Bravos. It is a small helicopter that has been modified to serve as a UAV, and the main difference between the Fire Scout Bravo and the Fire Scout Charlie, or X, is they're moving from one helicopter body to a bigger, faster helicopter, and it's not just the speed and endurance that will go up, but it's something that, whether it's a manned platform, aviation surface or subsurface, doesn't really matter. The key element that we're going to talk about here for a minute is what is being termed SWAP C, which is space.
Yes, and let's just say that the B model Fire Scout is built around what was originally a manned small helicopter from Schweitzer, whereas the C model, or Fire X, is being built around the classic Bell 407 Jet Ranger airframe.
Right.
So please,
both
continue.
Both of these are well-understood platforms. It's not new science. It's just engineering at this point. So the risk is substantially lower than if you were to try to build a vehicle from scratch to do this, which gets back to what we were talking about earlier, smart ways of doing business. So the new helicopter model that's being used is bigger, and it has more what's called SWAP-C, which is space, weight, power, and cooling. Now, with that, because you have advantages in those areas, you can put better sensors and communications equipment. All of those things and more are defined as payload. And if you listen to what all of the leadership are saying inside the Navy and elsewhere, it's not about the platform. It's all about the payload. In other words, what we're buying this thing, what do we want it to do? So as the Navy moves forward, goes from the Fire Scout B to the Fire Scout C, improves the payload, improves the range, improves the endurance, and again does that via a low-risk program, building a small number, as Rick was talking about. You get into LRIP, you build a small number, you take them out, you experiment with them, you use them, you find out what needs to be modified going forward before you get into full production. You make those engineering changes, and they buy themselves aboard the platform. Somebody might say, boy, I wish this thing could do this. Then you do the analysis and find out it's not worth the cost. There are other things that we could do. So this is going to go through that iterative process, and in the end, you're going to have something that started out as a basic show-me demonstration technology that actually turns into a very viable, usable fleet platform that the operators have had a chance to work with, to understand, and the biggest one is to accept.
Now, initially, they're not going to take, for example, a frigate or a cruiser and make it all either manned SH-60 LAMPS aircraft or all MQ-8Cs. They're going to operate mixed detachments with one manned helicopter and two or three of the smaller unmanned systems, and they're going to operate them together. How does that commingling produce both synergies and problems for the operators?
Well, what's going to happen is they're going to probably also keep the manpower in those squadrons, in those detachments, the same. So as it is right now, you have the same number of people maintaining two different types of platforms. You have two different kinds of spare parts, two kinds of maintenance instructions, yada, yada, yada. So as you go through and into the future and you commingle these things, you still have the manpower stressors, which is what they're documenting right now, so as to prepare for that eventuality. But yes, you're going to mix them because there are some things that manned aircraft are going to be better at doing. One of them is, we talked earlier about fixed-wing platforms operating in uncontested airspace. That's great. You want to operate them in Somalia or Iraq or Afghanistan? Knock yourself out. But if you put that in contested airspace, you get a different story. And with the helicopters, the at-sea environment, it's not just with TAC air or surface-to-air missiles, but there's also the contested space could be cyberspace. So you could have jamming, and there are data links and things required to operate UAVs, even those with a high amount of autonomy. If you can't see what they're sending, then the mission's lost. So in a cyber-challenged environment, in a jamming environment, anything like that, sometimes a man looking directly at the sensor, integrating it to his brain, gets you the answer that you're looking for.
On the flip side, you could have one of these things doing that dirty, dull, dangerous mission, just holding something under surveillance at bay 100 miles away, where hopefully you don't have to worry about it while you do other things with your manned aircraft like ASW.
Right. Assuming that you know it is, in fact, seeing it. And so you would have to be able to receive its data.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a jamming environment or something where you couldn't, then you don't know what you're seeing. And part of it, too, is the whole aspect of control. Can you control what you're trying to do in a certain environment. So, like I say, we're going through all this. Everybody's learning about it, and they're starting to gain a certain amount of acceptance of it right now. And I think as we continue to solve and work through these problems, 5 years from now, I probably wouldn't raise a lot of what I'm talking about now, because these are problems that will have been worked through by then.
Very good. Rick, back to you. Let's talk about the biggest of the systems, at least in physical size, which is the system known as the MQ4C, which evolved from something called BAMS. Talk to us about that.
Okay, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the RQ4A BAMS demonstrator a little bit earlier that the Navy is very happy with. And the MQ4C made its first flight in May. It's just a little bit behind schedule, but it's got a lot of improved sensors compared with a demonstrator version. It will contain a 360-degree X-band radar that can be used in many different modes, such as surface search or a synthetic aperture or inverse synthetic aperture and high-resolution modes. It has an electronic surveillance measure system that has specific emitter identification feature on it to look for potentially hostile or radars of interest. It has an electro-optical sensor turret. It also has the automatic identification system, and this is sort of like an identification friend of foe systems for ships, where every ship is supposed to broadcast its identification and where it's going, and it's so forth. And so this system will be able to, the Triton system, I should say, using the AIS, will be able to scan the ocean and identify most, if not all, of the ships in the particular region that it's looking at. It can fly at 60,000 feet, but unlike the Global Hawk, it is designed to descend in altitude to get closer looks, and for that reason, it has an anti-ice and a de-icing system on it, because of flying through clouds of moisture. The Navy plans to buy 68 of them, and interestingly, they only need about 25 of them at any one time, but they're going to build a large production run and store the rest of them, and then pull them out as the fatigue life wears out on the aircraft that are in service. There'll be 5 orbits throughout the world, staged from Jacksonville, Florida, Whidbey Island, Washington, from Anderson Air Force Base in Guam, Sigonella, Sicily, and a base not disclosed in the Persian Gulf region. We expect these things to enter service in 2016.
Now, when you talk about high-resolution sensors, let's talk just for a second to give our listeners a sense of this. An X-band radar is good enough that it can actually make out individual details on ships with almost photographic quality, to the degree that, combined with fusion of the data from the rest of the onboard sensors, they're going to be able to make out not only what kind of ship it is, but perhaps very closely what ship exactly it is, what C-frame it is and such, correct?
That's right. I think that's the intention of the what they call the ISAR high-resolution mode. The inverse synthetic aperture radar gives you a picture of the ship that, like you said, is almost photographic quality. And individual hulls have individual details. Not all ships of the same class look alike. They all have small details that are different.
Now, this aircraft is going to go and augment the new P-9 Poseidon maritime patrol aircraft, as well as the legacy fleet of P-3 Orions. How does the Navy see the line between what these unmanned aircraft will do and what the manned aircraft are going to do as they move into the middle of the 21st century?
Yes, that's the P-8 of Poseidon.
P-8, I'm sorry, yeah.
Right, the Navy is going to buy 117 P-8s. It's a small force compared to what we had at, the height of the Cold War, with some 300 P-3s as a maritime patrol force. So with the P-8, the Navy is moving toward a system where, by teaming it up with the Triton, the Triton will be used as a high-endurance, long-range surveillance asset, And then if it sees something of interest, a PA can be dispatched to go take a close look and get down at low altitude and photograph the ship if they need it photographed. If it's a contact of high interest, the PA will be available and launched. And this way, the Navy doesn't have to buy a larger maritime patrol force to go out and scour the oceans for the things that they're looking for. The Triton is a much more, in theory at least, a much more economical and effective way of covering much more ocean.
Fair enough. And now, gentlemen, let's go on to the big one, the one that's making the news right now, the X-47B UCAS-D demonstrator and its follow-on U-Class. And I'm going to start with you, Chuck. Talk about how the Navy made up its mind that it wanted to go and do a really high-end demonstrator for the capabilities necessary for operating a stealthy, tailless aircraft on and off of an aircraft carrier.
Well, I think there was some interest in determining whether an unmanned vehicle could fit in and how an unmanned vehicle would fit in on the flight deck. It was being discussed for a while. This administration came in and was very, very enamored with the concept of putting a UAV on an aircraft carrier. And I can say this is being done more by direction from the Secretariat level than it is by a perceived need at the fleet level. So this is a directed effort. The starter has been the Northrop Grumman X-47, which you pointed out, which actually is not, at least parts of it are not strangers to the aircraft carrier environment. The tail hook is from an F-18, the landing gears F-18, and some of the other internal components are also well understood technology and parts. The exterior mold line is indicative of a low RCS structure. Are you still there?
Oh, yes.
Okay, sorry. I thought I heard a click. But it's indicative of a low RCS structure. And what the Navy is trying to do is do this entry as smartly and as cheaply as possible. So you take the demonstrator model. Northrop Grumman was ready to go, took the UCAS-D, and off we go. The biggest thing that we've been talking about to this point are payloads. That's once you get it airborne. Getting it on and off the flight deck and handling it on the flight deck, completely different story. So the effort has been to, A, demonstrate that no matter what it is, you can get it on and off the flight deck and handle it while it's there. So that's one set of algorithms. That's one problem. The other problem is, how do you get it to land? Now, we've been doing what are called Mode 1 carrier approaches since the 1950s, which are hands-off. You couple up to the ship, and the autopilot flies you onto the ship. And I have done probably 30 to 40 of those landings myself. So that's not a challenge. The challenge is when you go away from a totally active system on the ship and you are sharing the responsibility inside the vehicle itself. And without getting too much inside baseball, that's what's really going on. You're not using a normal system that carrier aircraft have been using for 50 years. So as that demonstration moves forward, the next question is, okay, let's assume that this is going to be successful. What then comes of it? What are the missions that we want to do? Well, this, sort of like LCS, was something that's going to happen. Now, what are we going to have it do? There is an element to that that I cannot overstate. So, okay, let's look to the future. What do we want it to do? Well, now you get into what Rick was talking about earlier in his most excellent discussion of the whole requirements process. You have to set up requirements, and in that you have KPPs, or performance parameters that are absolutely essential, and you're willing to cancel the program if you can't do this. That is what the three manufacturers who are, there are four, but you look at the major players who are going to compete for the U-Class program, and they have all been chomping at the bit, waiting to hear what are the requirements and what are the KPPs, because otherwise they're designing in the dark for what they think the Navy's going to want. So this is really black art right now, both from the requirements standpoint, because they're trying to figure this out almost in reverse, the industry standpoint, because they're trying to hear what the customer has to say, and the customer not being sure. So it's almost like the Supreme Court justice that said, I don't know what pornography is, but I know it when I see it. Well, at some point,
we'll leave off the suffix on that, but yes.
But at some point, this is all going to gel, and we're going to have a U-class, which is not a demonstrator, that has a specified minimum range, that has some kind of a speed that with that range gives you endurance at that range, and has a payload that has been specced out so that you can take that payload and the capability that that payload gives you to a certain range and have an endurance at that range for a certain period of time, and then come back with sufficient fuel to get back aboard the ship, maybe 2-3 looks at the deck, whatever it is, and possibly have a refueled distance, which even doubles that. So that's the future. Right now is the demonstration. Everybody's excited about the landings that have taken place, and more probably today. And if there are any problems, they'll work through those. But this is a demonstration. The program is U-Class, and that is something that's in the future, probably, depending on budgets. If it survives the 2014 budget process, then you're probably looking at an IOC closer into the 20s.
Rick, you and I both last week were covering this story fairly extensively. I heard you on the NAVAIR telepress conference as well. Talk a little bit about what you've observed of these trials off the Virginia coast on the bush over the past couple of months, starting with the first takeoffs and then with the landings last Wednesday. Give us a few of your impressions of that.
Well, back in November, they took the X-47 on board a carrier and did taxiing trials and folded the wings, lowered it on the elevator, put it in the hangar bay, and saw how the airplane worked on the deck, and there were no other airplanes in the way for it to bump into. When they took it to sea the spring in May, they did a catapult launch, which was again, that's also quite a feat, and it's not as spectacular as a landing, but that is a milestone. That's very praiseworthy. And then they did some touch and goes on the next at sea evolution, where the aircraft approached the deck and hit the deck and kept on going, and then of course last Wednesday they took it to sea and they made two carrier landings on the USS George H.W. Bush. They intended to make a third, but there was a malfunction of one of the nav computers in the inside the aircraft, and they made a prudential decision to abort the third landing and recover the aircraft on a shore station at Wallops Island, Virginia. Everything went as planned. The first landing hit the number three wire, which is where you want it to hit. The second landing was a little bit different. The aircraft came in 9 inches lower, and it picked up the number two wire, which is still a good landing. And everything seemed to go well. The Navy and Northrop Grumman are very happy with the things. Everything went as it should have done.
And even that aborted third landing still taught them things, because it validated that the procedures for the aircraft to automatically go and abort and go and return back to the pattern as it's supposed to were demonstrated, which is something you want to do at some point.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, it's, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So generally speaking, I mean, I have to say, listening to Admiral Winter and some of the other program officials, there was a genuinely a buoyant spirit on the teleconference and a great optimism that the program is going to come to a very successful conclusion when they stop flying the prototypes later this year.
Yeah, that's right. They're going to shut down the program in December if it goes according to their plan. And then, of course, as the captain mentioned, the U-class will be the next step. And if you want to look beyond U-class, so let's assume that gets going and gets in service, then you have the possibility of an unmanned replacement for perhaps the Super Hornet in the future. You know, the Navy is starting its FA-XX program, which you're talking about, you know, a new fighter for the 2030s, and the companies involved, some of them are talking about, or the companies that hope to participate in the project, some of them are talking about manned and unmanned versions of that aircraft, or, you know, either optionally manned, where you could have the same aircraft, but you have the option of putting in a pilot or not. And so the success of the U-class program, if it goes to fruition, is going to have a lot of big impact on the future of carrier aviation. I think the captain might agree that one of the now that carrier landing has been demonstrated with an unmanned aircraft, there are some challenges in the future that you know whether the pilot will be taken out of the cockpit completely is a big debate. Just last week, Admiral Jonathan Greenert, the Chief of Naval Operations, said that he doubted that we will ever go away completely from manned aircraft. And of course, one of the big challenges is in a fighter plane is dogfighting. How do you dogfight with an unmanned aircraft? So that's one of the big challenges that remains in the operation of unmanned aircraft. And the other being weapon release. Current U.S. policy is that you have to have a human in the decision loop to release a weapon against an enemy target. And whether we're able to automate things such that UAVs can make that decision, I don't think we'll ever see that, at least not in my lifetime. But that's one of the another big issue that they have to look at.
Chuck, your comments.
Well, I'm taken back to a little anecdotal spot in history where Wernher von Braun was sitting with both sides of the manned-unmanned argument as to the Navy, as to the United States' first space program, whether it was going to be manned or unmanned, and these are the days right after Sputnik. And so he listened to both sides argue, and one side, a guy blurted out, "Look, we don't need men in the cockpit of this vehicle because we have, this is 1960, we have the most powerful computers in the world, and we just don't need a human being in the platform." Von Braun tapped his pipe into the ashtray and looked down and said, "The most powerful computer in the world is the human brain, and it's the only one that can be mass-produced by unskilled labor." So when you start to look at the complexity, not just of landing and taking off an aircraft carrier, but to Rick's point, you might be able to get an aircraft to guide out to a point, but how do you control it? And autonomously, how does it control itself in something as dynamic as an ACM environment where it's not just 1v1? It's not just a good guy against a bad guy. It could be a mix. So the sensors, all of that takes place, think about what it would take to replicate the flight control system, the inputs of a fruit fly, and how big would that computer be? Maybe someday we could fit it in a fruit fly, but right now, I'll take Admiral Greenert's point, and I'll take Wernher von Braun's point. It's going to take a long time before we replace the human brain in aircraft.
Well, as a personal commentary, I am left with the reality that we've got a ways to go in technology, both in dealing with situational awareness, reaction times, and reliability of controls and data links. before I'm willing to start programming Bob Shaw's book on fighter tactics into a UAV and arming it with sidewinders and AMRAAMs, obviously.
I think that's a wise bet.
Rick, you cover this day to day, week to week. How soon do you see the requirement for UCLASS being issued and the actual roles and missions being defined in a way that contractors can begin to start playing with their, you know, with their CAD systems and getting their war games programmed?
It's my understanding that the request for proposals will be issued by the Navy sometime later this year. And then that's when the companies put their brains together and they come up with a proposal that they will submit to the Navy at the deadline that the Navy gives them. So I believe it's this year. So I imagine in about, I don't know this for sure, I would imagine about a year after that they would submit their proposals.
So it's not happening overnight, but in terms of naval aviation and its development over the decades, it's going to happen, and there's going to be a contract issued somewhere by the late part of this decade. Is that a fair statement?
2020 is the goal to, or excuse me, to 2020 is the goal to have a UCLASS in service. And so if they make a selection, say by next year, or the end of next year, or the end of the fiscal year 2014, which I think is what their goal is, then you know, they would have a prototype flying within a couple of years after that, about probably around 2016, maybe 2017.
Okay. And gentlemen, I'd like to close out the discussion about Navy UAV systems by just talking about what each of you think are the long-term benefits and capabilities made possible by this technology, as well as the potential downsides of heavily investing in this. And Chuck, I'm going to start with you, if you don't mind.
Sure. Long-term benefits, being able to put long-dwell platforms in uncontested airspace. If you bump that up to contested airspace, those platforms will achieve a price point close to what a manned aircraft has now. So I think we ought to be looking at these things in uncontested airspace. If you put them in contested airspace, then you're probably talking about weapons release capability. If you're talking weapons release capability, you're talking having to have at least a link with a human being who's going to press the button and release the weapon or give the platform the approval to do that. The other upside is that it theoretically, it's yet to be proved, but theoretically we could get to a point where you don't need as many people to operate them as you do manned aircraft, especially in the case of a multi-mission aircraft. That will come much sooner, and we're probably already there. As for the single-seat or two-seat crewed tactical aircraft, we're not there yet. But for an aircraft that carries a crew of 12 to 14 people, we're there, but that data is still being analyzed by somebody back on the ground. The other
something,
downside,
some sort of reach back capability on a land base somewhere, probably.
Yeah. Somebody's still looking at the sensor data. Somebody's analyzing it. It's just they're not in the aircraft. The other thing that I really need to point out, and then I'll shut up, is opportunity cost. We are entering a period of fiscal uncertainty, except for the fact that we just don't know how low the budget's going to go. But the budget's going to come down. So when you look at roles and missions, when you look at the QDR and all of the things that we think we want to do, the uncertainty in the world, there are certain systems where you have to buy systems that, although they may not be Swiss Army knives, they at least play across most of the spectrum of warfare. If you buy things that only can play in certain spectrum, i.e. uncontested airspace, and you're making a financial investment in that, you're taking that financial investment in these tight times from something that maybe could play across the spectrum. So those are investment decisions, and with every investment decision, those in charge take a certain level of risk to make those investments. And so we'll see where this is, whether this is a political system or a warfighting system.
Rick, same question, your own thoughts.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to. I support what the captain says on the topics he talked about. One of the things that I would find interesting is to, as the Navy fields large UAVs such as U-Class or Triton, is the loss rate. If you look at the Air Force, I don't track their numbers exactly, but it strikes me that you have to raise a question of cost when you look at the numbers of Predator and Reaper drones that have been lost in mishaps or operations over the 10 years or 11 years or so we've been at war using them. And so that's I'm not saying that the cost of UAVs will be as expensive as using manned aircraft, but I just think somebody needs to look at that and see if it's really as cheaper to use an unmanned aircraft. But that said, I think there's a great future for the unmanned aircraft in all of these uses, especially in the ISR mode. And one of the things that it's helping the Navy do is it's reached its dream of network-centric warfare, where every platform in the Navy, whether it's a ship, a submarine, a UAV, an airplane, that it is also full of sensors. And those that sensor information can be data-linked back to create a comprehensive picture of what's out there, not only for the crew operating these platforms, but also for the strike group commander or other commander ashore that needs that information. It is creating a problem of overwhelming information, and like the captain talked about, you know, you have to have operators back ashore on the ship to interpret and to flow all this data where it needs to go, and so you have this flood of information, and that has to be managed, and that's still a challenge for our military.
Could I add one thing on to what? Let me add one thing on to what Rick said. Another benefit of this is that the tactical commander controls the asset. That is really important, whether it's the strategic Marine corporal in the foxhole or a commander skipper of an Arleigh Burke. That information is coming back to him, and he is the guy at the tip of the spear who most needs the information. It doesn't go to some CONUS-based analysis shop where it's then, you know, a day later turned around and available from the big, you know, internet in the sky. It's actual tactical data that could be used for targeting that feeds right to the operational commander.
Agreed. With that, gentlemen, I'd like to go and take the last couple minutes of the show and hear what it is you're working on and what you're doing these days. And I'm going to start with you, Rick. What do you guys got working over at Sea Power?
Well, we produce our magazine. That's pretty much our full-time job. We expanded to a website last year, and we post daily articles on the website as well. That information, some of which we generate and some of which comes from news releases from the defense industry and the military services. We put out, in every January, we put out an almanac issue where we detail the ships, aircraft, weapons, and sensors of the Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard. And that's pretty much what we do on a freelance basis. I write articles for some other military aviation magazines, mainly oriented towards the enthusiasts. And I've got a book project I'm going to be starting about the history of naval aircraft in the Cold War.
Excellent. Looking forward to seeing that. And Chuck, what are you doing? I mean, obviously, part of what you do is wait for phone calls from the lovely ladies at Fox News and go out and try and explain to the rest of us what the hell's going on. What else do you have working these days?
Well, the Fox News military analyst job is a part-time thing that I've been doing since 2001, and I enjoy that immensely. To pay the bills, I've got my own consulting company, Emerging Technologies International, Inc., which is a big name for a very little company. And what I specialize in is focusing on what I consider to be emerging technologies, which is something that may not even have a product home yet. It's a technology. Of interest to me for the last 10 years have been laser-based missile defense systems, primarily against infrared or optically guided missiles, such as MANPADs or some of the vehicle-based systems. But there are ways to use lasers to defeat those weapons, and it's very exciting. And as long as you have electrical power, it's not like flares. You don't run out of them. The other thing that I'm doing is I'm part owner of a company that does displays, and we do projection displays as opposed to liquid crystal displays, which gives you the advantage of, A, not being strapped to a commercial consumer electronics standard, which has all gone 16.9, and if you use your mind's eye and walk around the cockpits of airplanes, they're all either square or 4-3 ratio displays. So if you want to do form, fit, function replacement, and you want to buy LCDs, you're stuck going 16.9 because that's the HDEF standard. And also, that manufacturing technology left the United States, went to Japan, from Japan, went to Korea and Taiwan, and now Gen 10 is all going to China. So when you get into some of the cyber aspects of having a key component, irreplaceable component of your military system that you spent tens of millions of dollars protecting through development, and then you install Chinese hardware in it in the end game, there's the business case to be made that goes beyond simply cost, which we handle quite well. So those are the main things. Again, they're all pretty much national defense oriented, and all of them keep me busy.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you for sharing a little time of your Monday afternoon with me and my listeners and giving us a little bit of your insights, which are really excellent. Thank you for coming. Hope to talk to you again soon, and if you don't mind, you may get invited back.
It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Rick, Chuck, we're going to close this out. Thank you for your time. I'll talk to you again soon. And to all our listeners, this is the end of Military Monday for this week. Please join us at 1 p.m. Eastern next week for when we'll have someone else and another subject on Military Monday. Thank you very much. Have a great week.